previously on Unsolved. After Michelle disappeared, the cops came around again and started asking Joe more questions about the death of the baby.
Well, I know they told the Manders a bunch of lies about me.
Yeah.
And then they tried to relate it to my son disappearing. Or he didn't disappear, he died from SIDS.
What his knowledge about what happened that night would only be speculation on my part. I could speculate. He doesn't know anything of what happened. On the other hand, I could turn around and say, yeah, he was involved in it 100% from the get-go.
After the cops hit a wall with Joe, and after the private detective Michelle's mom hired hit a dead end with a sketch of a couple that had allegedly been seen with her in a cafe, Michelle's case went cold again. It stayed that way for 5 more years. And then a farmer walked into the sheriff's department with a tip about a serial killer. For the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I'm criminal justice investigative reporter Gina Barton. This is the final episode of Unsolved Season 2, A Toddler's Death, A Tangled Trail. On October 17th, 1972, Ed Edwards appeared on the television game show To Tell the Truth. To Tell the Truth was a TV game show that came on originally in the 50s, and it was pretty popular for about 20 years or so. And the premise of the show is that there's one genuine person and two imposters. So the three guys would say they were Ed Edwards.
Number one, what is your name, please?
My name is Ed Edwards.
Number two.
My name is Ed Edwards.
Number three.
My name is Ed Edwards.
And then a panel of celebrities would ask them questions to try to figure out who was the real Ed Edwards and who were the fakes. Edwards had just written an autobiography called Metamorphosis of a Criminal. In the book, he described himself as a young man who lied, stole, and spent time on the FBI's 10 most wanted list.
Number three, who was it in prison? In what prison, or did somebody in prison help you to get straightened out? I mean, or did you do it yourself?
Yes, I met a man who was a guard at the penitentiary, and he's the one that helped me to rehabilitate.
As he later told a TV news reporter, his life as a law-abiding citizen didn't last.
It was my intent never, ever, ever to get back into crime again. It was just that was my intent. So much for good intentions.
Edward Wayne Edwards moved to Jefferson County, Wisconsin in the summer of 1980. That same summer, teenage sweethearts Timothy Hack and Kelly Drew disappeared from a wedding reception at a banquet hall called the Concord House. Here's a clip from a TV news story that aired a few days later.
Besides helicopter and horseback searches, Jefferson County authorities are now checking out others who were at the wedding reception that night.
Complete lists of the two weddings that were held at the Concord House on Saturday evening are being gone through by department personnel at this time, and each subject person on the wedding invitation list is being contacted personally by phone.
The only lead so far has been a report of gunshots heard Saturday night by a farmer not far from the restaurant. And the search continued in that area today, but without success.
At the time, Edwards was working on the grounds of the Concord House. He and his family had moved from Colorado and were renting a farmhouse nearby. John Simon worked on the farmland that surrounded the house Edwards rented. Once or twice, he paid Edwards to help him move machinery from there to a different farm field. That's how the two men got to know each other. Edwards told Simon to call him Wayne, his middle name.
He had told me that he was Special Forces, if I remember right, Rangers in those days. He got to be kind of a local. You know, the guy hangs out in the barn, tells tall tales. Tall tales, so quite a few people knew him. You know, the guy at the end of the bar's got a big mouth.
The Edwards family came to the Simons house for dinner a few times. Edwards and his wife had five small children at that time.
So we felt sorry for them. Didn't look like they were fed the best. And she did not speak. It looked like a battered woman to me, but I'm not a psychologist. They're all very shy and stayed in the background. They were all obviously very afraid of him.
As part of the effort to figure out what happened to Timothy Hack and Kelly Drew, the police spoke to the workers at the Concord House and the campground nearby and the junkyard nearby, including Edwards. He told them he had been on the grounds that day, gathering up some tools to fix a sign at the entrance to the property. He said he never saw Hack or Drew and never went into the banquet hall. Simon told me Edwards and his family disappeared in a hurry after his chat with police.
Literally within an hour, the place, the shed and the house are emptied out and they're gone. They had the truck, the house is empty and the doors are swinging in the breeze and the key was laying on the cupboard. So we locked the house up and that was it.
In October of 1980, about 2 months after they vanished, the remains of Hack and Drew were found in a neighboring farmer's field. Here's a news report from back then.
Kelly Drew and Timothy Hack had been missing since they left a wedding reception in Concord, Wisconsin, August 9th. Their bodies were found just 8 miles from there, at the edge of a cornfield near the town of Exonia. The first body was unclothed, the second was clothed, and that clothing matched that worn by Timothy Hack the night the couple was reported missing. Up to this point, the couple was considered missing, and foul play was suspected. Now foul play is a certainty.
John Simon told me he and the other neighbors suspected Ed Edwards right away. He drove a van that matched the description of the one the cops were looking for, but that wasn't the only reason.
He had told us that there were some kids out on the lane, and he scared them, went up behind the guy with a gun and scared them off the property while they were fooling around. You know, he was just weird.
Simon said he told the sheriff's department about his suspicions, but never heard back from them. The authorities lost track of Edwards after that. About a year later, Michelle Manders disappeared from her home in the middle of the night. By 1988, the cases of five people who had disappeared or been murdered in Jefferson County had gone cold, including those of Tim Hack, Kelly Drew, and Michelle Manders. That year, John Simon was involved in a minor car crash, and he went to the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department to pick up a copy of the accident report. He had recently seen a story about Hack and Drew on the TV show America's Most Wanted, and it made him wonder what had become of his tip about Edwards.
Remember John Walsh and all that stuff? They had a cold case on it again. They had articles in the paper. And I had to go in for an accident report anyhow. So I said, you know, I still think that he was involved with it. That I don't know if he did, was a murderer, but I think he knows something about it at the very least.
Simon told the police Edwards had gone to the hospital around the time the teenagers went missing, and his story about how he got injured didn't add up.
He said he had a rifle and he was out shooting a deer, poaching a deer, so he had food to eat. He said the scope kicked back and the scope hit him in the eye.
I'm not a hunter, and I'm not familiar with how rifles work, so I asked John Simon if something like that could actually happen.
I could see where it possibly could happen, but not to an experienced gun handler. And it just seemed like, when somebody tells you a story and you go, yeah, right. Yeah, it could help. It happen. It's in the realm of possibility. But is it likely? No. Something else happened and it's an excuse.
The police checked hospital records and found documentation of a patient named Wayne Edwards. And that guy, Wayne Edwards, was treated for a broken nose, but not on the day the couple went missing. The birth date that man gave at the hospital matched up with a guy in Georgia named Douglas Wayne Edwards, but that was where the trail stopped. By that time, John Simon and his family had bought the house Edwards used to live in, and some investigators came out there to look for clues. The only thing that was still there that could be connected to Edwards was a piece of rope.
Now, the detective came out, he found that piece of rope, and that's all that was left at that point of what he had. And that was only because he'd used it to tie up the garage door so he could pull it down. He moved from Colorado to here, and the rope that was on the body came from Colorado. It was only sold there.
More than 10 years passed before John Simon heard from the police again. He says they came out to the farmhouse in 2009. And the reason they showed up was because Edward's daughter, April, had told the police she thought her father had killed Hack and Drew. She was a little kid at the time, so she didn't remember exactly where they were living back then. But she said it was a farmhouse with two spiral staircases. The police went to John Simon's house, the one Edwards had rented back then, to see if it was the right place. It was.
You know, just at the top one night, where there were two, it was about 7 o'clock at night, and the car pulled in with a spotlight shining around. And they asked if this is a house that had two spiral staircases in. And then when he mentioned April, I said, Edwards, and he said, yeah. He said her story checks out. That's when I found out that there was this big stack, and mine was the only report in there that mentioned his name.
By then, DNA technology had been developed, and the police matched a stain on Kelly Drew's pants to Edwards. Channel 15 in Madison aired this story shortly after he was charged with killing her and Tim Hack.
According to court documents, when police first interviewed him, he denied even recognizing Drew's name. Later in the interview, he changes his story, saying he was in the vicinity when they were killed. He says the reason his DNA was on Drew was because they had consensual sex. He then watched three other men stomp the pair to death in this field. That's a story that doesn't match for the brother of Kelly Drew.
So they could have only been at the Concord house for maybe a half an hour before somebody saw him leave. So everything that he says had to happen probably within a half hour, 45 minutes. Not very likely.
Edwards eventually confessed to killing Hack and Drew and three other people, a couple in Ohio, and his own foster son, who was 24 at the time. He told a TV reporter he confessed because his health was really bad and he wanted the death penalty. He also said he told the truth for his family's sake.
I'm thinking also of my family. I have put my family through God knows what. They don't deserve it. They're good people. They've been kept in the dark, like, for example, my wife and things like that. They've been kept in the dark about all of this.
The police couldn't figure out where Edwards was on the day Michelle Manders disappeared, and they never found evidence connecting him to her death. They never connected him to the disappearance of Kathy Schoberg, who vanished from an after-prom party at the Concord House in 1974. She has never been found. And the other mysterious death? The teenage boy whose body was found in the ditch in Exonia during that same time period? J. Kelly Flom? His case was never solved either. DNA made the difference in Tim and Kelly's case, and obviously it's helped solve tons of cold cases in the past couple of decades. But in Michelle's case, there is no DNA. There could have been some usable DNA on Michelle's mom's purse, the one that was found about a block away the morning Michelle was reported missing. But that purse wasn't preserved as evidence, and today, no one seems to know where it is. And that's really the whole issue with Michelle's death being closed as an accident. If it had been ruled a homicide, the police would have had to keep the purse as evidence. Tim Rhodes took over as police chief in 2008, and he had just recently joined the force when Michelle disappeared. He said he didn't remember much about her case specifically, but in general, under department policy, the purse should have been returned to Michelle's mother. I asked Jan if that happened.
Where's the purse now? Did you ever get it back?
No. But I think the police department picked it all up.
But they never gave it back to you?
No.
The purse wasn't the only piece of information into the investigation of Michelle's death that disappeared. As I've said before, most of the reports in her case have been destroyed as well. Orville Kwame, the retired Watertown detective who worked on Michelle's case, told me he wasn't consulted about what should happen to those reports.
I don't believe those reports are at the Watertown Police Department anymore. So, and unfortunately, I don't know why the detective that replaced the lieutenant, okay, and he threw those away a couple of years back. And, you know, that's not acceptable. But anyway, that was a decision that was made at the department, you know.
Chief Rhodes told me that he's not sure who made the decision to destroy the reports in Michelle's case. But in general, reports of an accidental death only have to be kept for 7 years under Wisconsin state law. That law is the reason why it would be really hard for the police to go back and reinvestigate her case now. Remember, her death was classified as an accident, even though there was no solid evidence about how she ended up in the river. The moment that this case fell apart as something that could be ever investigated again is the moment that it was classified as an accident. And so if somebody makes a mistake with that classification, that's it. That mistake can't be undone. Kwame says he still thinks the police made the right call when they ruled Michelle's death an accident. He believes she probably ended up on the Trestle Bridge over the Rock River.
And what occurred, or was determined to have occurred, is that the door was open, and Michelle, being the girl that she was, and bold and walking away, had in fact walked out the back of the house and went wandering off. She may have been looking for a light and had walked down that way, and resulted in her falling into the river. Just, you know, the train coming at this little girl in the middle of the night, and nobody else around. I can see that as a frightening experience for her.
Richard Perkins, who was the district attorney back then, doesn't think that's what happened at all.
It unsettles me that to this day that a little girl is let out in the middle of the night and walks down to the Rock River and drowns. That does not make any sense to me. I come from a long line of people who like to cross the T's and dot the I's. I don't like loose ends. And there were in loose ends in the little Manders case, little Manders girl case. Again, loose ends. I don't like that.
This case was obviously a super sad case, and one that's been very frustrating all these years later to look back on, because there was so much information that had been destroyed. Evidence is just gone. And no satisfactory answer and really no way that I can think of to get a satisfactory answer. It's super, super frustrating after all these weeks and months and all this reporting and all these interviews to still not have a working theory of what happened. I think the only thing that I definitively figured out here is that the police missed something. They had to have missed something. The idea that she just wandered outside, wandered over to the bridge, fell in the river, does not seem feasible to me. But what actually did happen, I think the only way that we'll figure that out is if somebody confesses at some point. Jan could not bring herself to hang up a picture of her daughter Michelle until 2009.
I could not handle having her picture up on my wall or anything. Because I constantly would see her because it just made me cry. And for some reason, that year, I just felt such a comfort and relief that I was able to do that finally after all these years and feel comfortable about it without crying when I seen it.
When Jan thinks of Michelle today, she tries to remember the good times.
I can still hear her singing it with me to this day, little voice. Michelle, my belle. She'd always say it all day after she'd hear her little, me play the album for her.
She sometimes wonders what Michelle would have been like if she would have had the chance to grow up.
Well, it would have been nice to have my daughter still on Earth. And even for Jennifer and Christopher's sake, I'm sure they've had been really close with each other. And be interesting to see what Michelle would have mounted herself into, what she would have been. I don't have closure now. But if I don't get it before I die, I'm okay with it. I just know that she's in a peaceful spot right now, and I'll see her in heaven.
Michelle's death has affected her brother and sister, Christopher and Jennifer, in different ways.
I do worry. I tend to be probably the more parent who's, I wouldn't say paranoid, but I double-check things. Like, for example, one of the boys wanted to go to the library after school, and my husband said he went to the library after school, and I'm like, did you go to the library and check on him? And my husband's like, I didn't even think about that.
Jennifer told me Christopher has always taken his role as a father very seriously, and family has always been a priority for him.
Family's always first. And especially with him having kids now, I think it kind of makes him more, even more so, a family man.
Before I did my first interview with Christopher, I sent him all the records I had about his sister's case and all the news reports from back then.
I really sat down Monday night and tried to get through it, reading all the articles, and it was pretty heavy on me. And my four-year-old likes to crawl on our bed, and usually he gets kicked out. So that night, I let him stay a little longer. And I just, you know, I kept him a little closer that night. And I just took comfort in him being there.
This has been Season 2 of Unsolved, A Toddler's Death, A Tangled Trail, from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thank you for sharing Michelle's story with us. Support our independent investigative work by subscribing to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Find the latest offers at jsonline.com/subscribe. You can find more online at jsonline.com/unsolved. Subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. Unsolved is reported by me, Gina Barton, and produced by Katie O'Connell. The project was edited by Greg Borowski, with web design by Aaron Coy, photos by Mark Hoffman, graphics by Lou Saldivar, and video by Lou Saldivar and Bill Schultz. Our copy editor was Debbie Davis, with social media outreach by Emily Risto. Andrew Mollica worked on interactive graphics. The news reports you heard in this episode came from WMTV, Channel 15, and WKOW, Channel 27, both in Madison.